So I thought I'd start with this bag or box or vase, whatever you want to imagine it as. If I had a group, well, actually, you guys aren't on camera. So since I have a group of 10,000 people listening, I'll just pretend it was bigger. And I said, I'd like you each to, in turn, reach into the bag. Everybody's going to have a particular response before they even reach in the bag. In fact, probably as the bag gets close. Is that a snake guy? Does he look rich? Maybe there's extra money for me. Is there something icky in there? Is there something that's going to prick my hand when I reach in? Because I can't see what's in there. And if, however many people I just said, if there's 10,000, 5,000, 1,000, whatever number of people is, roughly half of the people are going to put something in the bag before they find out what's in the bag. The other half of the people are going to put something entirely different in the bag before they reach into the bag and perhaps take something out. Half of the people will put hope into the bag. Right? He looks like he has a lot of money. So there's probably dollar bills in there. Or maybe, I love snakes too. I hope there's a snake that certainly possible. And the other half of you, and you know who you are, will put something different in the bag. Fear. He looks like a bit of a prankster. He doesn't know this is a fancy shirt. That it doesn't look like it, but my mom gave it to me. I don't want to get something drippy on it. Well, you know, what could be in the bag? So when you hear these, hope and fear are things you put in the bag. You probably also hear which one you are, most likely. It's not straight down the middle. You're not always going to be afraid of anything. You don't know what's in it, and you're not always, somebody else won't always be hopeful. It depends on the context. Do I look mischievous? Am I overexcited to see you? Did you just see me prank somebody else? You know. So that'll depend on the situation, but you might have a sense that, oh, I know where I tend to go. I'm going to tend to be pessimistic. I'm going to tend to be optimistic. And given a particular situation or set of circumstances, you may respond different than you ordinarily would. Does that sound right to everybody? Right. But the problem is, now that you've heard this, the hope and fear are things you put in the bag before you find out what's in the bag, you've already established that one is better than the other. And you might have further established that I'm the person that tends towards the good one. Neither of those things that you put in the bag have anything to do with what's in the bag. So hope, and I may be in trouble here, is not better than fear. It's different, for sure. And it probably feels better. Neither hope or fear are related to the moment that you're in. The moment that you're in, before you reach into the bag, is not the moment of deciding what's in the bag. It's its own moment. It's just the moment of a mischievous person going like this. That's unrelated to what's in the bag, or what's not in the bag, or what two things are in the bag, or how you'll respond to what's in the bag. So what we're doing, when we put something into the bag before we're at the stage of deciding or discovering what's in the bag, we're stepping outside of the moment. We're stepping into a different idea in the mind about this moment before your hand's in the bag. Or maybe before your hand isn't in the bag, you might just say, nah, forget it. I don't want to. And that's a response that's taking you out of the moment. How many people have I lost? Good. That's good. So half the room, roughly half the people, are going to be hesitant when they go to open that door or look in that thing that's in the fridge that you're not sure what's in it, right? Or go down that street they don't know or open that box. So it's contextually different. If it's wrapped in the gift wrap and your mom gave it to you, you're probably going to tend towards, I hope that she knows what iPads are, you know. And then so you're opening it up with hope because that's contextual. It makes more sense unless it was maybe my mom. Then it's probably snakes and coal, you know. So half the people, half the time, will be hesitant, which is an indication of fear. Half of the room will be alive with excitement to some degree, right? Nobody has any idea what's inside the bag. And yet half have given the unknown dread. And the other half, roughly, have given the unknown excitement. So hope and fear are born of a broken connection to now. Right? So of course, we can learn to enjoy that before. A lot of people will tell you as they grow up, you know, the excitement of Christmas morning is maybe better than the toys turned out to be. Right? So we can learn to, and people will go on amusement parks and have that real shift between hope and fear on the various different rides, and it's designed to play on that, taking you out of the now moment, right? If the now moment just simply had your butt coming out of the roller coaster seat a little bit, that's kind of interesting, but it's really exciting when you had expected to be going down and you went up, right? Because there's a break in the connection between now and what you had expected. So why do we long to leave the present moment? And perhaps more importantly, have we ever been in the present moment in order to be leaving it? So we have this idea that if I give hope or give fear to the unknown, it takes me out of the present moment. But was I really in the present moment to begin with? Right? If you see me, well, I have a gift for you. Like, you're probably long outside the present moment. You've leaped ahead. Well, it's five steps to you. You're six moments ahead. This is great. He didn't know it was my birthday, but I guess he remembered. So then you've mortgaged six moments that could have been yours. Six moments that could have been yours, and they're gone. So I will not complete the I Ching tonight. So they just did three lines. These three lines, hopefully, can you guys all relatively read them? I'm going to explicate, so it probably shouldn't matter anyway. So this is a simple way to describe how a Taoist would see the world. So when I say Tao, hopefully you can hear the T, which in the romanized version of the Chinese is spelled T, but it's pronounced a little bit more like D or DH. But at any rate, this is Tao. So the lower line is Earth. The upper line is heaven or sky, which I don't mean to make sound religious, but it's just that not thing that's not the earth and not us. It's not necessarily a place either. So heaven, earth, any guess what the H is in the middle? Humanity. Yeah, well done. You win a gift. She's like, I already know there's nothing in it, but I'm still excited. So heaven, earth, and humanity. We're right in the middle. Any guess? No idea, right? Yeah?
Soul, body, mind,
slash almost? I don't, okay. Maybe you can't read. He's in the back, so in fairness. It's an age, yeah. So this is body, spirit, and mind, heart, right? So I wrote M/H, and, you know, I don't write well, you're far away, and you can't read. But well done. That was not bad, really. So I come from a Chinese studies background. That's where Taoism, you know, that's the country of its origin. So I can't really just write mind, and I can't just write heart. I have to write shin, which is a Chinese or mind heart. When we English speakers or Westerners hear Mindharp, we hear two things that are somehow jammed together because they fit in a category. But the Chinese or the Taoists don't see it as these two things that are jammed together. It's a thing. It's a energy. It's a state. So they don't have a word mind slash heart. They have shin, which helpfully confuses our anatomy even more because we think, why would it be the shins? That's so, and even then, there's two of those, so maybe that's what they meant. So it's, the whole thing is confusing. And by confusing, I mean exactly this simple. That's Taoism. There's no more to Taoism than that. Luckily, I can say a lot more about it, so we got some time to kill. So body is the same as earth. Right, so our body, what is substantial, what is made flesh, what is physical, is earth. So we could describe it as the earth element or fitting in the earth category, or the earth is represented by the body. So the spirit and heaven, those kind of make sense, right? Kind of where you expect spirit. So mind heart is here, humanity. What makes humanity different than what's below and what's above is the mind heart. It's the thinking and the feeling. It's not to the provenance of heaven. It's not the provenance of the earth. Those are completely different ideas. So, just to prove that I can write, because this might have been here before I got here, we could also have a timeline or timelines, which, you know, normally we just draw this way, and I'm going to just write now in the middle. And the timeline can be then or then, right? It can be future, past, and present. Those are your three basic divisions of time. So when we have future, I don't know why I wrote TNT up on the, it's wrong workshop. Sorry, I meant Nobel Prize. I didn't mean to write, it was supposed to be a very subtle thing for the committee that's here tonight. So, when we have future, past, oh, I'm getting in more trouble, I'll just finish that. Past and present, and you're probably already figuring out that this is really the one I care about because I didn't get any gifts on Christmas. Future, past, and present. So my question is, this is how we can divide time. How much of this can be in the present moment? Which of these parts can be in the present moment? All of them, absolutely. We have another winner, but the lady next to you got the prize, so you just had a great answer for no reason. So all of these can be in the present moment. Now, how often are they in the present moment? Even right now, you're waiting for my answer. Your mind left this moment. Right? So not so often, right? One of the things I really enjoy doing is looking at a picture of an enlightened being or a saint or a statue or something like that. Because even if it's not a photograph, it's representational of somebody that's fully present. And it's a real nice way for me to tune into, oh, that's a possibility. Because if I just look at humanity, you don't often, or maybe it flickers here and there among different people, but when you see a great being, right, whether allegorical or mythical or otherwise, it still tunes you into, oh yeah, it can all be right now, because it was then when they painted this, right? So the next part, the past. Can your body be in the past? No, it can feel like it's stuck there to some degree, right? But the body cannot be in the past. Can the mind heart be in the past? Right, absolutely, right? So the mind heart can be in the past because you can grieve, you can worry, you can overthink, you can plan, for sure. Can the spirit be in the past? Well, I don't know. Why would I know? I mean, how do I know? I'm not a preacher. I don't know anything about the spirit. But I'm guessing. I'm guessing it can be. It's got to be able to do stuff the mind heart can't do. But for my argument, it doesn't matter if the spirit can go in the past or not. So next question. We did present, we did past, and we'll do the future. So future, can the body be in the future?
No.
Of course not, right? So another one of those. Can the mind heart be in the future? Sure, you're all thinking, I hope he finishes talking. There you go. And I would be so overjoyed if he would just shut up. So there's your mind and your heart in the future. Pretty straightforward. Can the spirit be in the future? I don't know. Does anybody know, or do we want to believe, or do we seem to think, or does it stand to reason that? Sure. But do we know? We don't know. Right? And if somebody knows, they got more gray hair than me. Like, I really don't know. But again, for the purposes of my argument, it doesn't matter. It probably can. It makes sense. The spirit can go wherever the heck it wants. It totally makes sense. But I don't know. So here's my question. Where can all of the parts of the self meet? Anywhere else? No. The only place that all of the self can meet is in the present moment. Old English. I think they told me not to use the blue pen. But there you go. Old English, hail, which became a couple different versions, some of which I'm not sure I can remember how they're spelled. I don't think that's one of them, but we'll edit this in post. We'll make me look smarter. Good. So this turned into the word hail, H-A-L-E, which, because it's such an important idea, this Old English word, which means whole, W-H-O-L-E, such an important notion, wholeness, that we now use it only when we talk about soup. It's the only time we ever use it. That's how important it is. When we're talking about soup, we say hail. And we don't even leave hail good enough on its own, because whole is not whole unless you say hearty for some reason. You have to say hail and hearty. So the Old English word for health was whole, W-H-O-L-E. So what do you suppose whole means? What do you suppose health means? I suppose that it means all of you is in the same place. In the moment any of you leaves that place, you're not whole. If I'm still worried about what I said to my boss yesterday, and I'm still thinking about I'm supposed to buy a baguette on the way home, my mind's here, my heart's here, and my body's here. My body can't go and meet the rest of me anywhere but here. And the rest of me, and again, maybe the spirit too, but as you can see in my argument, it doesn't matter. It only matters that the body can be nowhere but now. Where the spirit might be or not, might not be doesn't really matter, because the body is only here. And so if the different facets of yourself or the different braids or threads go anywhere but here, you're not whole, which means you're not healthy. So health can only be found in the present moment. Right? When I do treatments, people say, well, what are we headed towards? Like, what is this treatment going to do? Is this going to, you know, get me on the toilet? Is this going to make me sleepy? Is this going to give me a lot of energy? And I say, I don't know what's going to happen. I'm trying to get us here right now, because we can't all be here, because you're still mad at the guy who stepped on your foot, and that's why your ankle's sore, and that's why I'm treating it. And I'm still thinking, oh, I hope we finish by 9 because I have a class. I'm trying to just get myself present. I'm going to try and help you be present. And sometimes being present means in that body that's sore or bloated or itchy or tired or strained or just old, which probably covers all the other ones, right? So in my mind, what leads us to a state of non-health, what the Chinese would call dis-ease, is putting something in the bag. I don't know what the future brings. And by future, the very next moment, the very next breath. I don't mean 10 years from now. But I don't know what's coming. But I do know that if I get there before all of me gets there, I'm not healthy. It's coming anyway. I don't have to go meet it, right? So it's my feeling that what leads us to disease, what leads us to non-wholeness, what leads us to ill health is the very notion of triggering and engendering fear and hope, both of which serve to bring us out of the moment. Maybe mind, maybe heart, maybe spirit, doesn't really matter, but if any part leaves the moment, I'm not healthy. Have I lost anybody? Okay. So, I guess I'll, that one didn't really work. I was going to do it differently. So when we find ourselves experiencing either hope or fear, it's always an indication that at least our mind has left the present moment and that therefore your mind and body are not in health. I say at least the mind certainly could also, often if you're thinking about something, you're also bringing your heart with it, right? So it's a charged thinking. It's not just, weighing the consequences. This is not the same as planning. This is having part of you run away with more of you from the rest of you. So, I'm about to wish I could draw. Yeah, I do. I wish I could draw, which is unhealthy because right now it's enough. Oh, fantastic. I was saved. Did you see that? Like, that's bad. I think this was wishing I couldn't draw. That is amazing. Thank you very much. I'll be appearing all week. Please tip your waitress. So, that was just amazing. See, you guys are all wishing I could draw. Can anybody here draw? Okay. So what's funny about this horse, stay with me, is that I live on a horse farm. You would think I could do that. Stop it. Just stop it. And give you guys all a timeout. So this is a Mustang. So what a Mustang? Yeah, I know. It doesn't look like the car or the horse. It's just a nightmare. Look, they didn't invite me to come do a draw. They asked me to come do a talk. So anything extra is just extra. Leave me alone. I mean, that just looks horrible. This is another reason I recommend you get the audio version of my talk. They produce a DVD, but it's a ridiculous idea. Look at me. Just get the audio and listen. Absolutely. In my school, I sell the audio for a higher price than the DVD. And my students all think I have it backwards. And I'm like, no, because I got to charge more. You don't have to see me. It's totally worth more. So this is a Mustang. So a Mustang is a wild horse or a feral horse, which is getting more specific, actually. So what makes a horse wild? Well, it doesn't have an owner. It doesn't have fences. Nobody feeds it. Nobody grooms it. There's no farrier. There's nobody feeding it or grooming it or whatever. Right? It's just a horse out in the prairie, probably eating, where you don't want them to eat. So let's say, for example, that this distance, from the horse to, just the end of the, I don't know if it's called a whiteboard or a gray board or the board. This horse at the most can travel, let's say 50 miles a day. And at the most, it's going to have 5,000 days of its life, or just to pick some number. And so let's say that this mark here is 100,000 miles away, just some giant number. Like the horse could never, ever get here if it happened to just go in a straight line and never stop. So I don't know what that number is, but I'm going to just write 100K. And so in other words, that's just forever away. The horse will never see that fence, even if it says, dear horse, this fence is for you. It'll never happen. So I'm going to just build that fence here. I don't know why I'm doing that, because the horse will never know, and it's certainly not stopping the horse. But at this moment, What we have is we have a Mustang and a really stupid idea for a fence and really expensive and all the rest, right? They would argue that Taoists would say any fence is a stupid idea. There's a division can only happen in the mind, right? And when you're used to a division happening in the mind, it starts to happen here. And when it starts to happen here, everything else falls apart, starting with your health, ending with other people's health, and then eventually progressing into society's health. So to recognize differentiation and variation is interesting, but to actually make a fence, to actually attempt to divide the world is not helpful. This is a basic description of the world that the Taoist sees, but this is not a division. But it's hard for us not to see it that way because I see the black side and the white side and the S shape in the middle, which reminds me of the snakes in the bag, and I'm worried about that. But it's not a, this is a, an indication of a wholeness or a health, a healthy world. So I've done my fence at a $3 billion cost or whatever, and I have this Mustang. So then I'm loving this fence idea. I mean, I've gotten healthier. I've killed more trees. I'm super excited about this whole thing. So I build another fence here. Same idea, 100,000 horse-o-meters away, right? So what do we have? We have a Mustang and a guy building two stupid fences, right? Or an L-shaped fence, fair enough, right? So I'm not gonna keep drawing, but there's another fence, right? Sure, I will. There you go, good. So there's our other fence. So what do we have in the middle? We have a Mustang who is totally happy, freewheeling, never will see the fence, totally happy, living its completely wild life. Fair enough. So I'm gonna build this fence, or not. There's the next part of the fence. Notice that I have not completed it. I ran out of dedication or money or split rails or something. So now we have a Mustang and this nearly four-sided, or maybe we can call it five-sided, fence structure. So we have a Mustang, and they have this weird border. So I build a little bit more fence, and I just check. Oh, there's a Mustang, there's a fence. I don't know why we're doing this. You guys probably don't either. You guys are probably putting stuff in the bag by now. But now I'm gonna just build this last little bit of fence. The moment I build that, I have a horse, not a Mustang. Mustang, horse. So this would be far more clear if I just built it 1 acre away. We'd see that really fast. Before I finish the fence, it's just a Mustang who hasn't figured out it can still go. But the moment I finish it, I have a horse, not a Mustang. Does that make sense? All right, so it matters not if the Mustang ever comes up to the fence. It only matters that it's now enclosed. It's now captured. It doesn't have to be tame to not be a Mustang. It's a horse. It switches from Mustang to horse. So of course, the fence is hope and fear. And of course, the fence is not built by some farmer, it's built by you. Can you imagine how you build your own fence? You bound in yourself. Unrelated to the reality. The present moment for the horse will never include a fence. It's too far away. So the horse, now that it's a horse, is not free. It's a pet. Our fears limit us even when we don't walk right up to them, right? So that fence is there if you've built it. It might be way over there. You might not even reasonably get to it in any, you know, reasonable amount of time. So whether or not you walk right up to it, if you've built that fence, there comes a point at which you're changing something nearly the same as your fundamental nature. Or for all intents and purposes, you're changing your capital S self. I would call that unhealthy. Did I lose anybody? Apart from the drawing part? Good, I'll repeat your question because they don't have the microphone out.
the Mustang does not know about the boundary, then in the Mustang's self, he's free.
Sure, right. So the Mustang, did you hear what she said? She said that if the Mustang doesn't know that there's a fence, then the Mustang feels free. So is that the Mustang being free? Well, going back to when I treat people, which is also the same as teaching them quite often, a lot of times people will come to me, and it's very clear to me that there's a fence, that they're not free, that they are broken, that they are wounded, that they are injured, but they don't see it, right? The truth is that they're not free, that they are broken, that they are wounded, that they are injured, that they are unwhole. And I have to help them see that first and then do the work. What's the work from there? Is it grounding yourself? Is it tuning into it? Is it finding the fence? Is it disassembling the fence? So what's important to me here is that whether or not the Mustang ever finds or discovers the fence is there. It is no longer actually free. It feels free, right? Don't we all know somebody who says they're healthy and believes it, but you know, I mean, you're their close friend or their coworker or their mom. You know they're not, right? And generally, the first part is to develop their awareness about that, right? Help them see how. Not to help them feel bad, like, hey, I know you're feeling free here, but you can't just go wherever you want. It's a horrible life. It's not about that. It's about if you want to find that freedom, you have to find where the gate is. You have to find where the fence is and hop it, break it down, talk somebody out of building it, you know, whatever the case is, right? What I like about this notion is that with the Mustang, it's an easy way into the notion because you picture some farmer, you know, building a fence and, well, once we figure out the fence is there, I'm going to go kick that farmer and tell him not to build a fence. But the harder level is when you start to realize I'm the Mustang, my true S self, right? Capital S self is the Mustang and there is no farmer. There's just other parts of me, like mind, heart, for example, building fences. Whether or not I find them, whether or not I know I'm doing it, whether or not I meant to, or even knew that those actions I was doing constituted offense, right? Then that's a lot harder to accept that I'm building them. But I have found that whenever you figure out where the difficult stuff is, that's the stuff that's worth doing. I have not figured out how to get people to pay me to study in those classes to get that work done because it's hard stuff. But the truth is, if it's good for you, it's going to be difficult. It'll probably be expensive in terms of not just money, but time and energy, right? And slipping back, right? Like feeling some improvement, slipping back. And if you're a teacher or a student, you've started to recognize this as an adult. The easy stuff is generally not worth it. So it would be easier for the Mustang, the horse, to just say, hey, I've run as far as I can run. I've never even seen a fence. So I don't care about your theories about me being a horse. I'm a Mustang. And it's like, well, that's cool that you feel that way, but that's not your truth. And so now your feeling of your truth is incorrect. And that's kind of a horrible thing. I mean, the Mustang horse feels good about it because, I mean, everything's dandy. I mean, I've checked. I've never seen a fence or anybody building it. But it's not their actual truth. And to find and face the actual truth is the first step towards growth, right? Or at least some sense of that truth, right? The big truth is going to be that much harder to find and recognize, right? So we had another question. Yeah. She's bringing you the mic, if that's cool. We're going to record you, and now this sure. DVD will be worth something.
Well, I understand metaphorically what you're saying, but if we want to extend the metaphor, mm-hmm. this Mustang living within this realm of this fence that he doesn't know about. I mean, that same Mustang, even if he tore the fence down or before it was built, it presumably lived on something like a continent,
mm-hmm.
which has borders and oceans surrounding it. Horses can't cross oceans. He didn't know about that either, so
sure.
already he wasn't a Mustang. Also, we have the other concept, like this lady right here brought up, that if uh-huh. you have a polar bear and you raise it, you when it's young, you ship it to a zoo in a cage, it will always think that its world is the the length of that cage, they pace back.
Sure, sure, yeah.
There's a famous phenomenon about polar bear cages.
Yep.
So even if you take that polar bear and release him back into the Arctic, he'll still have
He'll have that small sense, right?
Yeah, that small world.
But that's a broken.
It is about the beliefs.
That's a broken sense of polar bearness that polar bear never got a chance to fully see.
Yes.
The geographical boundaries, like the continent, those are natural physical boundaries.
But so are fences, because they were built by humans, and humans are part of nature.
Sure, absolutely, yeah. So it's a relatively easy thing when we start to talk philosophically to continually come back to this idea that humans are nature, and therefore whatever we do is natural, including nuclear power and plastics and whatever else you want to think. So it's a relatively easy thing, and I don't mean to sound like you're trying to make it facile either, but it's a relatively easy thing to just keep coming back to that notion that, well, we're natural too, we're born of nature, and that's fine. But before we were around, there were neither horses nor Mustangs. There were no names. There was no distinction. There was just beings, right? So once we arrive at the place where there are horses and Mustangs, and that distinction was made by us in terms of who we keep as pets, who we breed, you know, the fact that you own that land, I own this land, and so on and so forth, we've created artificial boundaries, which you could, again, argue are natural because we're part of nature too, but we've created non-primal boundaries, new boundaries, in terms of naming and in terms of physical boundaries. So the continental boundaries, which might even, you could just think of in terms of a river or a lake, that would also keep maybe the horse from crossing. It doesn't have to be getting to the continental shelf. But then that is what a Mustang is. A Mustang is that being that's free to go wherever it wants to go, save for cliffs or water or something like that, not to be artificially changed by where we happen to build our wall or our fence. That kind of makes sense?
Well, that
right.
makes sense.
Oh, sure.
I think there's what this lady said has a lot of validity.
Yeah.
That it's actually on the level of the awareness of the Mustang is at least as important as the
sure. Mustang. Sure. It is. So I know I see a lot of clients who start with a false notion of things are okay or things are happy, right? Until they realize what the bounds are, where they could have been. And then it feels like a step back often, like, wait a minute, I felt kind of happy before I learned this. Now that I know that there's that boundary, I want to go break it, and that's going to take work and money and time and all the rest. So just as I don't want to ask the person that's accused of a crime whether or not they did it. I want to have a jury decide. I don't want to go by, I asked them if they're happy, they said they're happy. I don't want to go by you. I want to go by a jury of the peers. So I don't want to ask the Mustang or horse, do you believe you're a Mustang based on all your evidence? I want to look at a larger picture if I can. And of course, in fairness, this is a metaphor too, right? So, you know, somebody's going to raise their hand, well, I happen to own horses, and I'm sure that they could jump over the fence or something, but it's just a metaphor of how we bound ourselves, whether or not we come up against those boundaries, whether or not we find the resistance of them. And that boundedness is an attempt by us to describe the not now, right? Which can be the past or the future. So what I wanted to say, do you need to ask something just now? Or
good, yeah.
Yeah, good.
Well, it has to be now, because it can't be.
Yeah, absolutely, for sure. Another winner, he's bringing the microphone to you.
All right, so I happen to own horses.
Yeah, of course, right, and I can tell you that.
It on?
It sounds like you're on.
Okay, so going back to a bit of what she said earlier, uh-huh. If the horse is unaware that the fence exists, then the truth and delusion look the same to the horse, right?
Yes.
So
great.
Then you are perhaps, and I know it's an analogy and all that, but like
yep.
you say, all right, well, the client comes in and the patient, whatever,
mm-hmm.
and they don't realize that the fence exists, but you can see the fence. But how do we define the fence? How do we know the boundary? How do we know that it's really keeping them back? How do we know the difference between the fence that's truth and the fence that's delusion? And the you know what I'm saying? So how is that?
Yeah.
How is that actually identified?
Yeah.
By you or by someone outside of the fence? You know, do you understand the gist of my question?
I do. Yeah, that's great. That's fantastic. So, first, it's a matter of finding the fence, the barrier, the border, the boundary. And then it's a matter of asking yourself, have I built this? Was this here? Is this just a broad river I can't cross, or did I have something to do with this? And then sincerely working that question, because your first answer might be, no, I don't remember building it, right? Or I didn't purposely build it. It might have been an accretion of my actions, but I know I wasn't trying to build a fence for myself. And sincerely working that, right? And when I say sincerely working, it's code for kung fu, which is a Chinese term for sincerely working at it over and over and over and over, right? With your full, authentic, sincere, dedicated, heartfelt, true effort over and over and over and over and over. So it's really knocking at that door, that gate, that fence, that barrier, whatever, and saying, did I have something to do with this, or was this just a natural thing? So if you feel like, man, I just still haven't been able to fly, I must have convinced myself as a kid with this psychic break that I can't fly, and now I want to get rid of that fence. We didn't build that one. You know, I mean, you just can't fly. That's just a physics thing, right? But you might have another idea that you can't jump very high. Right, and that might have been born of, well, your older brother, who's 4 years older, was a track and field star, and so you had this psychic problem of trying to not get in competition who somebody that was older than you and already better. And now it's like, okay, maybe you haven't built that wall of not wanting to go out and stretch yourself in that way. And your first thought might be, I don't remember building that wall, so no. So what's the truth and what's the delusion? It can't be answered simply. It can only be answered by some real work. And not people shy away from that, or people start it, or people get a false answer. They do a little work, and they think yes or no, I got the answer. Does that kind of make sense? Yeah, thanks to you.
Stephen, can you give
Yeah, she's, we've shifted into the Q&A portion, I guess.
We're
so
in
that's
the Q&A? Okay.
Thanks, Renee.
Do you like Steve, Stephen, Stephen?
Hey, you.
Hey, you.
Great. Yeah,
okay.
Sure.
Hey,
yeah, you're most pontiff. No, just Steve is great.
Would you be willing to give a little bit more of a, I'm trying to think client here.
Uh-huh.
So client comes in and they feel absolutely great, just are curious and want a treatment.
Sure, yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
And, so
and a lot
believe-
of times they can come in and they say, well, you know, I have this tennis elbow, and it's a simple thing, but then we're getting into some deeper stuff from there, right? So they may be coming in with a real physical malady. I want to work on this. I want to do some stretches or breathing for that. But then we lead into, okay, your competitive nature has brought us to this point, and where did that come from, and do you want to work on that, right?
Okay.
Right. So did that... sounded like you had more to your question, though.
Yeah, a little bit more.
Sure.
So I'm thinking, like, perhaps somebody might come who thinks that they're absolutely extraordinarily healthy, but they're just curious and want a treatment.
Sure.
And yet you check them out and you say, ooh. And so that's different than someone who's coming in and just saying, I've got this thing over here. And that get, in a way, that the elbow gave you a little bit more permission to give them a
little bit more. Absolutely, yeah. So it's not my job, I feel, to grab them by the ear and walk them to where I've seen the fence.
Okay.
But it may be my job to encourage them to take a longer walk than normal. And, well, I'm afraid to go over that little stream. Well, you know, it's a nice day out. Maybe we will walk through that stream, and then maybe we will find the fence. And then I'll say, well, that's curious. What do you think about that? Does that seem like it should be there? Do you want to work on it? So it's not a question of I know better or I'm going to fix you even though you're just here for your strained finger and we're going to fix all of your issues with mom and your sisters. You know, I'm not going to drag them by the ear to every fence. But if in the course of a treatment or a lesson or a student-teacher relationship, we come upon these fences, right, which are always related to the not now, right? The fence is preventing me from getting there. And there is the same word as then. Right, distance and time are the same. They're both measuring the same thing, right? So a fence is always bounding my now, right? And the noun needs no bounding. It may be experienced as bounded because it feels very finite, right? And it may be experienced as boundless, but it is without any bounds, right? Whatever your perception may be. So I don't feel like it's my job to talk people into, well, here's the fence I think you have. I've seen this in other clients before or anything else, but maybe encourage them to look around and see what else is going on, right? And then, you know, because my job, I think, is partly to help people find where the work is. I mean, very often people will come in and they'll say, hey, I want to study Tai Chi because it's supposed to make you have better balance, right? Fair enough. And they say, well, I'm 60 now and it's harder to, totally reasonable. But as we get into it, I start to share with them, well, balance is not just in the body, is it? Right? And the different sorts of balance are interrelated. So I might be able to have what you might call pretty good sort of physical balance. I could do this for half an hour, which that would be one crazy boring DVD. We'll just switch it to a photo. Just here's the thing with the audio playing. So pretty good physical balance. But if you started to say, your mom that you don't have a good relationship with, she just called, she's coming up, and I think she's mad too, and like, and you start getting into my heart, or he starts tapping his toes that's working the mic, and he's like, hey, you know, we're running out of time, and you know, like, let's wrap. Maybe my physical balance starts to evidence what's happening with the mind-heart, right? Similarly, if I don't have particularly sort of great physical balance, I'll try and make it, but I can get my mind-heart into a balanced place, then I can see the evidence in the physical body. The same thing would be true of the spirit, but why would I get up here and teach anything about the spirit? That's just ridiculous. I mean, I don't have any kind of religious anything. I don't know anything about it. But I just figure it's probably part of this whole thing, right? My definition of spirit, by the way, because I need a working one, is everybody's comfortable with what the body is. Not, I didn't say comfortable with their bodies. Just they get the gist of that. And they're comfortable with what mind and heart is, although very often not understanding the degree of their boundlessness. And my feeling is that if you think that when we add these two up, they add up to something less than what you consider all of you, then the remainder I'm going to call spirit. So my feeling is that spirit is, if you feel like there's something more to you than just the first two categories, whatever you want to, wherever you want to locate that or name it or give it, you know, its own provenance, then I'm going to just call it spirit so I can have a working discussion. The last thing I kind of wanted to talk about is comfort. So when we think about hope and fear, very often we don't. We mull the results of hope and fear, or the object of hope and fear, not the actual hope and fear. So comfort is a response to fear and hope. Fear and hope are both thoughts about the not now. Comfort is the promise that we give ourselves that we will not have to confront the coming and unknowable moments. So only the now is knowable. Very often the now is not even known. I'm saying knowable, not known. Because really, who does the work? But the now is the only bit of knowability. That's a cool word. Of knowability. The future, the past, unknowable. The past starts to feel like, maybe I could know that. But really, have you tested your memory? Did you have the complete perspective on all of that event? No, you just had yours. And now it's charged with your limbic response to that, as well as your, however broken you put together the pieces, right? You know, we perceive our memory like it's a videotape. You just cue it up and you see it, but it's not at all. And even if it was a videotape, that's just still one point of view. It's not the whole thing. So the now is what is knowable. Very rarely known, but it's knowable. That's, again, going back to look at those pictures of the saints or whatever, where you're like, wow, you look like you're actually knowing this. When I say knowing or knowable, I don't just mean from here, do I? Right? From the Chinese background I come from, I don't think of knowing as here. I think of it as at least these, and also the whole here. In the introduction, he mentioned pushyans, which is a practice of two people interrelating, practicing at relationship. And a big part of the knowing that we're trying for there is physical. There's contact. There's a connection between two beings. And then, of course, it spreads beyond that. There's an emotional connection. There's laughter. There's words. There's a lot more. We're trying to get the selves to know one another, to interrelate, to connect, to engage. And to the degree that you're able to engage with your own now, your own self, whatever parts are constituted by self, you're then able to engage that with another. So to the degree that you know yourself, you're able to begin the journey of knowing somebody else. So comfort is the promise that we give ourselves, that we can stay right here in the know and knowable, right here in the now. Comfort is this promise we give ourselves that we won't have to look in the bag. I don't need your dollar bills if you put money in there. I certainly don't want to reach in and pull out a slimy snake. So I'm fine here. I just came for the talk, really. Don't make me reach in the bag. So comfort is this rejection of the coming moment. And what's nice about it is it doesn't feel like a rejection. It sounds like you're pro now. Comfort sounds like, I like this chair. I don't need to get up. I'm feeling good. This tea is just, I'm just fine. So comfort has the added wonder of making you seem comfortable with the notion of comfort. But in fact, it's an active rejection of the coming moments. What I think of it as is inertia, chronological inertia. Comfort is, I'm going to just stay in here in this knowable moment, which I haven't perhaps bothered to know apart from this is a cushy seat, and that's it. What I find, we talked about the hard work and stuff, none of the hard work has as its ingredients comfort. None of it does, just none of it does. You know, like my avenue is martial arts, and there was no point at which the teacher said, well, the next lesson, which will surely get you enlightened, will start like this, and feel free, hold your hot chocolate. And what we're going to do, like it never was there, you know, it starts with, okay, we're going to be here. Now hold this dumbbell. And now you're a dumbbell. There's three of them. And you're just going to, like the work will start like this. And then, as you can imagine, it gets worse and worse, especially if you see me do it. It really looks bad. But none of it is comfortable. Now, it doesn't mean that it's recklessly dangerous, but it's not comfortable. If you're comfortable sitting on your couch, get up and walk. Doesn't mean you have to do a marathon, but get up and walk. If you're comfortable with your ideas, go have them challenged. Nobody's going to resect your ideas and put their own in. They're just going to suggest theirs. You bring yours out to meet. You have it just like we're having a discussion. And the idea is not to prove your own and remain comfortable in your notion. It's to test them and feel. And maybe you take in something new. Maybe you gave some of yours. Maybe a third thing comes from that free zone. Right, so what I see comfort as is it's this real danger of rejecting the coming moment, but it doesn't even feel like it's rejecting anything. It feels like it's pro now. They're like the difference, they say, how fast can you run if you're running towards something you love? Well, not as fast as if you're running from something you're afraid of. Right? So, like, comfort really feels like it's facing now, but I argue that it's facing then, right? It's a different experience, and it doesn't feel like it. It really feels like when I say I'm comfortable, I mean, that rice was great. I got my favorite kind of tea. The music's on, and the lights are just how I mean, my phone's off. Everything is just, it sounds like it's really about now. But it's really about, I don't know what I have to gain by reaching in that box. I don't want to reach in there. And then it doesn't matter if it's fear or hope that's preventing that. So I'm going to tell a quick story about that. So I wrote in my notes for this. Let me just, you guys know when they shoot video, you have to have continuity. Everybody knows about that, right? So, you know, if we edit it and then like this is that way, it'll just show up weird. Like, wait, it was. So for continuity's sake, assuming I'm going to do this every year, I'm going to read this like this. Because I think in the DVD in a few years, I will be like this. So I'm going to just do this, and then you guys will think, oh, he's always just read that way. So what I wrote for my notes was corn, corn, poverty, corn. So I'll tell you that story. So I got on a train in China 10 years ago or something. Got our tickets and the crazy mess of an Asian city. And the train station. So got in, got the tickets, and I forgot how long the train, 2.5 hours, 3 hours. So it was kind of like New York to Boston kind of a train. So I think I grabbed a bottle of water. I'm like, all right, got my bottle of water. And I know I have like the rest of that book I was going to read or the rest of that magazine or something. So I'm cool. I'm fine. I'm not going to like change my shoes or at least a couple hours. So anyway, we got off that train. I think 31 hours later, something. Now, I don't know how dogs do it. You want to go for a ride? They jump in. And you're going to the vet 6 minutes away. Or you're going to Montana, family vacation. I don't know how if you said hop in my car, I'm like, how? Do I need 2 bottles of water? Should I bring a sleeping bag? Like, I want to know, roughly, is this a 3 hour or 30 hour? Right, that's it. Am I being unreasonably American? I wanted to know it was a 31 hour train ride. They told me it was 3 hours or something like that. And I specifically remember, you know, we're going along and for a couple hours, you know, the sun's rising over there. And then a short while later, the sun's still rising over there. I'm like, but it's not like we just rounded, for a couple hours, we're done. Like, did they get lost? How do you get lost if you're on a train track? I don't know. You know. And of course, you can't just ask anybody here in China. Like, it's just between the culture and my broken language and their complete not caring about what I wanted. Put that all together, I couldn't ask. I don't know if I mentioned there was no bathrooms. It was just horrible. This is another reason to get the audio version. You have to stand between two train cars. So get the audio version of this talk because you don't want that visual. So I remember sitting there, and I had a few students with me and stuff, and so we're kind of trying to talk about big stuff, and we can't really get up and practice too much, so we're talking philosophy and so forth. And I remember just looking out the window, you know, just scene after scene, and what it was just corn or rice or wheat or whatever it was. Corn, corn, corn. Oh, look, poverty. Corn, corn, poverty, poverty. Well, that's pretty poverty. Corn, poverty. For like 20 hours. Like when I've been on a train in the States, you're like, oh, that's a bad section. And now we're somewhere else. Or there's a field of some stuff. And now we're somewhere else. We're in a small town. But it wasn't like going by 6 hours of poverty and despair and squalor. Like it wasn't, I've never had that. But like you'd fall asleep and wake up and there's just still poverty, poverty, you know. And so, I mean, it was really deeply affecting because if you've traveled by train, you know, you see the world differently than by car. You see the back of buildings and yards when you're going by train, right? When you're going by car, you see where they put it, at least threw a few tulips in and painted the front of the house. And when you fly, you don't see anything, right? You just see your Netflix or whatever and then you're in another shiny airport. Right. So it was really moving just to like, look how much just squalor. And I know I'm reading into it. I can't stop and talk to people. So I'm assuming it's a horrible life and they're probably happy anyway. But it's still like, boy, that looks tough. That there's not even a roof on that. And that's just, I'm sure that's not clean water. I see that, you know. And so we really had this like hours long back and forth philosophical discussion about what you owe the world and what the meaning of happiness is. And can you really be poor if you can't really own anything, like, whether it's money or not, you don't own it. It just passes through. So all this really deep stuff. And we're really emotionally affected by the purported lives that all these people have out the window. And we're practically moved to do something about it. You know, that's how really we meant what we were saying. We very well might have donated $20 or something. Like, I'm sure we would have done something if we weren't on that train. And I remember as we're talking, you know, you may have noticed I'm not a small guy, and I'm in a rail car in China. It wasn't the most comfortable place. And I remember just thinking, you know, you're just talking and talking. I'm like, you know, I would just give somebody $400 for just a sweater so I could just put it under where this has been digging in for 2 hours. Like just the, like some little thing, right? Or if I could just have just like a sip of somebody's Sprite instead of this water. Or if I could just, you know, stretch my leg out like 2 more inches if this guy would wake up and let me, like if I could just do it. And so you're making these little adjustments. And you're literally, I don't know if I mentioned it was like a 30 plus hour train. It was just, I might cry. It was horrible. And you're literally at this point where I would give somebody hundreds of dollars just to, you know, you just put a sock under my heel so I didn't have socks on or something, you know, just, or give me a little thing that'll cover my eyes so I can lay back or anything like that. Not a big, it wasn't like wishing for, I wish I was in first class. It was just like, I just want, if you could just, somebody bring me a cracker, like I would just, and so of course you solve it, right? Somebody's like, well, I don't have a cracker, but here's a piece of celery, or somebody else was like, I don't really have a sock, but you can use my bag and put your foot in, like, so you solve it, right? And then like within an hour, hour and a half, there's something else that you're willing to spend hundreds of dollars to fix. If this door window would just close all the way, I would just be so happy. Meanwhile, corn, corn, rice, rice, poverty, 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 poverty. And all I care about is how this little stupid thing is digging into my arm and how it's been $100 to fix it. So I felt like the lesson of the train ride was how much more comfort, how much more important comfort was to me than actual pain, than actual fear, than actual hope. Right, as we're talking about the fear people must be in for just their health when they drink that water, or when the tsunami comes and what happens to that ramshackle building, or the hope they must have or not have, and really the only thing that moved any of us to action was, I just got to get up. If you could just stretch my leg, or can I just share that carrot stick with you, or something like that, and like, it started to dawn on me, like, really one of the most powerful catalyzing forces in anybody's life is comfort. People will run towards, build up, make important comfort in a way that they won't with other things. And that comfort is an explicit rejection of now. It doesn't feel like it. It feels like right now I just want to put something under my foot so it stops rubbing on that little bolt on the floor or something like that. But it's really about, I don't want to move into next. I want to stay in the knowable now. So when we think of what's in the bag, what we think of what's in the future, we tend to think black, right? So the unknown is dark. And so what we want to do is we want to fill that with something. We can't just be okay with it being what it is until I get there or until it gets to me. And then it'll be now, and then I can know it then. When it's now, I can know it. So, what's the remedy? How do you regard an unknowable not now without fear or hope, or without rejecting it in that sort of comfort chronological inertia? How do you do that? Well, for me, what I do is I remain centeredly or groundedly curious. So to me, where there's curiosity, there's no room for fear and there's no room for hope. So if you're an optimist, when you hear me say curiosity, you might feel like that sounds kind of like active hope. That kind of, but curiosity doesn't have to have the charge of optimism or negativism. I could have said pessimism, right? Oh, well. So the reason I say groundedly curious is that I don't mean leaning into the next moment. That kind of curious. I just have, you know what? It's been a long talk. I have got to. It's not leaning into a curiosity. It's not the sort of curiosity that uproots you and pulls you into another moment. It's groundedly curious. Insofar as my mind is regarding that thing that I can't know because it's not here yet, it's not now, I am curious. I mean, you made that really nice package and it's got the gold bow. I'm curious what's in there. But I'm not going to become unrooted. I'm not going to become ungrounded to the now. If it's coming to me and you're going to bring me, you did bring me a gift, right? If you're, then I'll find out when it gets here and you say, hey, you know, here's your thing and I brought you the, I don't see anybody with a gift for me. I've been waiting for somebody, send somebody out, get something. I'm talking and talking. Just go get him something. He really needs something. But you guys are just not into it. So what I wanted to suggest is that when I, and I'll practice if I just sit like an outdoor cafe and just watch actions of people, whatever they are, what I can read with practice is how every action is motivated by fear or hope. Right? So expectation of either negative or positive. An easy way to do it is look at advertising. Right? It's either going to be selling you hope or it's going to be selling you a fear followed by, here's the answer, here's the hope, right? And often it's a selling you of the fear because you didn't know you had it, right? They're going to say, you know, what if when you have guests, they look at your water heater? Well, here's the new water heater cover. And you're like, I didn't even know I was supposed to be worried about that. I got to buy one. So they sell you the fear because you didn't know you already had it. And then they sell you the hope. And other types of advertising is just selling you the hope. It's just because everybody knows, you know, tired of your socks smelling? Well, here's the anti-scent lotion that you put, or whatever. And all right, great. So I don't need to be sold on the fear. I already have it. Just tell me what the hope is. So what I do is just like in an outdoor cafe or something like that where you can people watch, or Grand Central's terminal or something like that, just watch any action and you can see how it's been engendered by hope or fear. Like, that's why you're grabbing your daughter's hand that way, right? Or that's why you're looking that way. That's why you're moving that way. That's why you're doing that. And you can see what it's doing. And the things that prevent an active engagement with the now as it arrives are comfort. And one of the solutions to that is to be groundedly curious, to stay centered. And often, as we do in our studies, is practice that physical centering to help you find the rest, right? So it's relatively easy to find the physical centered and grounded and rooted in balance, and then use that as a platform or a viewing place from which to recognize where the rest of the parts of you are and have them all meet. And then be curious. And the curiosity, I'm trying to simplify, but it could be related to the past. It could be related to the future. You can be curious about the now. But the only thing that you can know is now. You can't know a not now. What I see here is that I've went through two of my 7 pages of notes, so I think I have my talk for next year already. to give you an idea of this, a lot of times you'll see in Buddhist iconography, you'll see these two mudra, which are these they're asanas of the hand, and they're little postures that can be experienced largely in the hands. One is the Abhaya mudra, like this, and the other is the Varada mudra, which is like something like this. And often you'll see, and I like to do this with the statues. See, the statue, it's almost always the right hand. This is often seen as fearlessness or protection. So it kind of makes sense, like, you know, that bad stuff, stay over there. And this is welcoming in the good stuff, which I think of as the coming moment. But what I really like to see it as, not so much like I'll practice it or I'll teach it and I'll have people do it in different postures and stuff, but it's not so much doing the posture with a person, but I really like it when it's a statue, because that really feels to me like, oh, that's always now. Like that whole thing is rooted and grounded. Meanwhile, it may have its awareness tuned towards a coming moment and saying, look, no fear. I don't need any fear. Correct, right. So one of the cool things about it is that when you're looking at an iconographic representation or a statue, something like that, is that that Buddha is not looking out at you saying, hey, I'm going to keep the fear away from you, or I'm going to invite in. That Buddha is you. Right? That's the whole idea of the Buddhism, right? Is that I am that. It's not an other, the Buddha. The Buddha is a representation of that higher you or self or realized self or what have you. And so when you're looking at that statue, like, oh, that's me doing that outward, which is a simple remedy or a way to tune in a physical and emotional way to that experience of now. Okay, so I think we'll start to bring it out to questions. And do you want to put an actual button on it in terms of taping, or do a few questions time-wise?
We'll take some questions.
Great.
I'm sure there are a lot of people with many questions now. Hold on.
Well, this goes back pretty far toward the beginning. You were talking about the
body.
I've
completely forgotten what I started with. I'm practically off duty right now. But okay. Go ahead. Okay. Just go ahead.
Okay. I'll call you tomorrow.
Yeah, that would be great. Thank you.
You said the body was not able to live in the past, but I've been reading about body memory, mm-hmm. in which intense physical or emotional events are encoded in your body. And,
sure.
And so is that a way the body lives in past, or is there something else in there?
That's a great question. I'll relate it to, a lot of times I'll say, you know, can our mind go in the past? And people say, well, yeah, I had yogurt this morning, and I clearly remember that, and Fred was there. Fred can vouch for me, and I even took this selfie of me and the yogurt, so there's your proof. And I'll say, well, that memory and Fred's words and that picture are all here now, present, right? So they're artifacts that point to a past, right? And same as your Christmas list or something, that is an artifact perhaps that points to a future, but it exists in the present. It's the only part that's knowable. So insofar as saying that the body has a memory, that's a present experience, right? Of artifacts in the body, maybe they're scars, maybe they're sores, or even hesitations, right? The last time I pinched you, now this time you're going to do that before I pinch. Those are now experiences, but they relate to a not now. And that's where, if I go to pinch you, your mind goes to 2 weeks ago when I pinched you and you said, don't ever do it. And then your emotions get into, what does this guy think he's doing? And immediately the heart and the mind leave the now. They have stuff to do, right? And then you're not present for the experience where you could have just punched me out and said, don't do that, I told you. Right? Or hugged me, you know, it's yin-yang, really. Does that help? Yeah, thanks. Thanks. He'll bring the mic, I think.
Just
thank
please
you.
Wait for the microphone.
Great.
Now we want to record the question.
Okay. What he just said, it caused me to think that at the distance at which we're functioning here, even at this distance, I can never perceive you in the present.
Absolutely right.
For two
Correct.
Reasons. Synaptic delay in my own brain
sure.
and nervous system, but also because of the speed of light.
Absolutely.
And sound is even slower, and it doesn't make much difference to us until we get to bigger distances.
But it's a truthful
so that's
difference.
That's what astronomy is about. We can see things that happened
then,
a million
right
years
now.
Ago
right.
Yeah.
The
and
6 billion year light.
Now.
Yeah, exactly.
And so what is now anyway, then?
Right. So
exactly. What is now?
So now must exist outside of any ability of the mind to abstractify, right? So any abstract or abstractification that helps me try and discern or describe the mind or the body or the now or anything is necessarily that even seeing, as you suggested, with the speed of light, never mind the amount of time to reverse the image and then make sense of it and then name it, when I feel like when I'm seeing you, it's now. But of course, it's just then, right? But close enough for colloquially, sure, it's now. But touching and feeling is faster than that. That's faster than the language. So if you're having a limbic response or a physical, emotional experience, it's a little another step closer to now. And if you're meditating in this really wonderful and the birds are all hanging out with you and the moonlight, even though it's daytime, is on you and you're really meditating, you're a lot closer to now, but still not now. Because if we're going to discuss it, we're outside of the now, right? So the idea is to step us closer and closer to now through our practices. And some of them are just as simple as tuning into it and being aware of it. All the practices don't have to look like you wear a special hat and get sweaty and bow to the right thing. They don't all have to look like that. They can be just simple tuning ins. But the now cannot be described by anything abstract, including language, right? So I was going to get into a whole thing about the nervous system and so on and so forth and start to describe some of what happens in terms of the hormones and the serotonin and so on and so forth that's going on in the different systems in the body. But you guys didn't look like the most literate group. No, I'm just kidding. I wasn't sure I'd remember it all, so I just skipped. Well, let's just talk about fences, and we're all much happier. But you're right. We're necessarily outside of the moment insofar as all of the tools which I can use to apprehend things are a step away. But we can step closer and closer to those moments. And I would deign to say that in a really idealized meditative state or enlightened place, you're nothing but the now, right? But I can't know that and I can't express it. It's just an idea, you know? She had a question just next to him, if you want to. Thanks, John.
I'm a little confused by the difference between meditation
mm-hmm.
and mindfulness. And I myself teach yoga and meditation. And yet, philosophically, sometimes mm-hmm. I find that people want to go to a Himalayan cave and meditate, and they sure. want to escape their life or their reality.
Yeah.
And then that's really, to me, kind of that's what came to mind, that that's really not being in the present moment. And that's whatever that means, you know, that we yeah. just discussed. But, you know, even in, you know, I know people are, they're looking for something with this idea of meditation.
Yeah.
Of going somewhere, being somewhere, when really isn't it about, like what you're saying, it's about every moment. It's not about even sitting in meditation. So I don't, you know what I mean? I'm a little confused.
Sure,
on
sure.
Why do we meditate? Why isn't it more about every moment being, the goal being to be present and to be aware? Whereas, you know, a seated meditation seems almost like you're trying to escape something.
Sure, absolutely, yeah. So this is one of those great things where it's really helpful to, as a teacher, to inquire after the reasons for somebody saying, I want to sit in meditation. This is brought into sort of sharp relief more often when you have not just somebody coming into your class and giving the $12 drop-in fee and doing a class, but when somebody's going to join the monastery, they're going to join the temple, they're going to become a monk, they're going to renounce. Often you'll have a doorkeeper, some head monk sort of person, who won't just say, glad you're here, glad you got rid of your CD collection and you're here barefoot. They're really trying to figure out, are you coming from something or towards something? And that's a really important first question. And it's probably not just a question, it's a whole sort of interview, I suppose. Because they don't want people just coming that are getting away from their tough life. And then they have this fantasy of everything will be better at the monastery, I'll have my food taken care of, and then I can just focus on this. I have that good part of my life where I feel good when I do yoga, so I'll do it all day and I'll feel great forever. And that's really about escaping something. And so it's not a just, let me see what's on your checklist. Oh, you said you're coming towards it, come on in. It's a real process. So initially you asked the difference between meditation and mindfulness, not metta, but just mindfulness, right?
Yeah, because I find that the tradition that I was
Mm-hmm. It's an Himalayan Institute tradition. Yeah.
It seems to be more about being in the present moment.
Yes.
And so to me, it seems like they're almost two different things in a sense.
Sure. So there are many paths, right? If I'm going to spend my time and energy making a flyer, it's going to be about the path I know and believe in. And that's the one that's on special this month, and come and join my studio. But somebody else has another path. It's probably just as valid, right? So it's really, I think, a question of finding what's the best suit for you. And it's not always just trying on the first suit that you feel good about, right? So it's often work. So in many cases, people just feel like, well, I just have so much going on here, I can't shut it up. So for me, I want to do something active. And so they do yoga or Tai Chi. Whereas if they really had an honest and authentic discussion with their true self, maybe with the help of, you know, an instructor or something, they might have said, okay, that's a little too easy. What I need to do is that little harder thing where I do need to sit on a pillow and meditate for hours, and that may be for them the right thing. But I think it's problematically false to suggest that, well, there's this way and that way. Now, obviously, the question is, which is the right way? You know, like, I'm not enlightened. Why would I know the right way? Like, I can just tell you my way, and I believe in it, and I can make good arguments about why it should be working and lead us somewhere good, but will it get us all the way? And even if it does, I can only tell you about my experience. You're a whole different animal. Like, I won't draw it, but you're a whole different animal. And so I think it's important to really figure out why, and I know you're asking also for your students and stuff too, not just you, but what you're trying to get out of it, what you're willing to do, what you expect of it, and why you're really doing it. And that's not an easy question, just like when you have the, when you sign up for stuff, here's my name and my address and my, you know, emergency contact. Those are pretty easy. The questions I'm talking about often need to be returned to. And if the practice is moving you somewhere in a healthy direction, you'll get healthier and healthier answers. And you know what I mean? A really good friend of mine had, and he's a fat old bearded guy, not a martial artist in the physical sense. You know, he's a martial artist up here. He's a scholar. I really hope he's not buying this DVD. Hi, Rick. He once had a confrontation where, and it's, this would be great if you knew Rick, because why would he be in a confrontation? He's just a little doughy, meek, really wonderful guy, just fantastic, a beautiful man, a heart like you wouldn't. But he's not what you'd call a physical specimen of any kind, and he doesn't read that way at all. And he once had this weird confrontation, like some stupid over a car parking space or whatever. He tells the story great. So the big rough and tough guy got out to, like, let's make this physical. And he said something as he approached Rick. And Rick is like, there's nothing I'm going to do apart from wake up later. I'm not going to just try. He's not a guy who's going to try anything. He's just, I'm about to get punched out or whatever, however this looks. And as he approached him, the guy said to him, what are you afraid of? Right? And Rick said, everything. But it was beautifully authentic. He had done the internal work. He wasn't making a tactical, if I make it a little funny, maybe it'll disarm. He was actually answering the question. He was actually answering the question, like, I've done the work. I'm afraid of everything. I really am afraid of everything. Right? And that had this remarkable effect where this story doesn't end in a punch out. You know, the guy just was like, wow, I got a real answer. But those real answers are hard to come by. They take work in and of themselves. And a lot of times, and you may have seen this in your time studying, I imagine you've done it for some time based on your posture and stuff, that we get those first answers, you know, like, what am I going to study? Am I going to do this type of meditation? Or am I going to go to that cave? Or am I going to study with that lady? Or whatever. And people get some progress there, and they get to ask better questions and answer deeper questions or re-answer questions, and then they shift, and now they're doing ballet and they're singing, you know, and that became their path, and that's not wrong. That's great. So a lot of times, if the path is productive, it's going to help you figure out what the best path really is for you. And it may not be where you started. As a teacher, I always hope it just stays with me for 30 years. And, you know, of course, but the truth is that if I can help you figure out the questions to ask, the ways to ask them, how to be more and more progressively honest with the answers, which will take time, that's layers, then the path will be more clear to you. And it may not include me. You know, and that's part of it, you know. And it may not include me just because you got further ahead than me. I'm just back here teaching the beginners. So, you know, as a teacher, my absolute most fervent hope is that I will teach somebody who can be my teacher. Like, I'm hoping that I can create somebody who I can now I have my teacher. Do you know what I mean? And until then, my teacher is really just everybody. And there's not an awful lot I can do about that. It is what it is, apart from just continuing to apply myself and teaching. So those paths are, they're, if you're moving forward on those paths, you're getting somewhere. When I first started teaching, my teacher, or just before I really started teaching, my teacher said, you're going to teach now, you know, something to that effect. And I, of course, immediately, there's no way, I could never, are you kidding me? She's way better than me, and I'm not ready at all, don't make me, you know, like, you know, and he's just kind of King Kong with the biplanes, everything I said, he's just like, that's just ridiculous, he's just batting them away like so many biplanes. And what he basically said to me was, you're on a path, and it's a valid path. It's not necessarily the best one, or it's not the best one for everybody, but it is showing results, right? And it may be the more circuitous and torturous path too, right? But it's a path and it's getting results. And he says, you don't have to be where I am on that path, you know, which is way up, you know, he's been doing it for 50 years. He's like, as long as you're on that path and it's a healing, whole-making, learning path, right, productive, if you look over your shoulder and there's anybody at all behind you, you can teach. It doesn't have to be 7,000 people clamoring with $100 bills. Like, if there's a person that you can say, hey, man, I watch that rock. I just went over it. Like, let me just, and they might then run ahead of you on the trail. That's great. You know? And then what he said after that is, I know you. You're probably going to really keep studying an awful lot. And by the time you're really worried about you've taught everything you know, you'll have the